Greetings, warriors, veterans, and America Loving citizens from sea to shining sea. Welcome to Frontlines of Freedom. Hoo-wah! I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. On the 4th of July, 1776, in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, the Continental Congress adopted the Declaration of Independence, which proclaimed the independence of a new United States of America from Great Britain and its king. The declaration came 442 days after the first shots of the American Revolution were fired at Lexington and Concord in Massachusetts, and marked an ideological expansion of the conflict that would eventually involve France's intervention on behalf of our Americans. The declaration was formally adopted by 12 colonies after a minor revision. New York, the 13th colony, approved it on July 19th. On August 2nd, the declaration was signed. The American War for Independence would last 5 years. Yet to come were the Patriot triumphs in Saratoga, a bitter winter at Valley Forge, the intervention of the French, and the final victory at Yorktown in 1781. In 1783, with the signing of the Treaty of Paris with Britain, the U.S. formally became a free and independent nation. Let's be sure to celebrate our nation's Independence Day this coming Thursday, and be sure your family and your friends know why we're celebrating. God bless America. Okay, joining me at the 50 caliber microphone today is Marine vet Skip Coriel. Have you been doing any weeding this week, Skip?
Oh, gosh, yes, Colonel. Well, you know, the weather has been so hot and humid across the whole country. And on the one hand, that's bad because it's uncomfortable for us humans. But my garden loves the heat and the humidity, but so do the weeds. So I've been on full-time weed patrol, kind of a search and destroy mission out in my vegetable garden. But hey, I kind of like it, Colonel. It's odd.
Well, yeah, I'm not fond of the really hot, but hey, we dreamed about this in January with the snow was here.
Yes. Be careful what you wish for.
Amen. Okay, here's what we have for you today. On news and comment by the Colonel, I'm going to discuss the war in Ukraine. Then Chief Warrant Officer Roland Ashby will contribute his warrant wisdom. Ambassador John Bolton will discuss some of our nation's issues. Then Elaine Donnelly from the Center for Military Readiness will share her insights. Terry Lanning will present a song he hopes will become our military's national song. And Diane Raver will present the movie of the month.
Hey, troops, please invite your friends to join us at this time on this great radio station. Then head on out to frontlinesoffreedom.com and sign up for our free e-newsletter. And join the conversation at facebook.com/frontlinesoffreedom.
We welcome your input to this show. Send us your ideas and comments through our website, frontlinesoffreedom.com, or by Facebook. And now it's time for news and comments by the Colonel on Frontlines of Freedom. Skip, before you take us there. As Hezbollah continues its daily attack against Israel, including over 40 rocket and drone attacks in one day, it's clear that the Israeli military is preparing for an additional escalation with Hezbollah. A couple of days ago, Israel's prime minister and president toured Israel's northern border and met with military commanders there. Israeli President Isaac Herzog said that the international community should not be surprised if the situation spirals out of control, citing Hezbollah's repeated violations of international agreements. Also this past week, Israeli troops in the north trained for, quote, extreme scenarios, including combat in complex and mountainous terrain, activating fire, and urban warfare, according to the IDF. The exercise was conducted, quote, as part of increasing readiness in the northern area. I fully expect Israel to invade Lebanon and take out Hezbollah. They really have no other choice as they want peace. Okay, Skip, take it from there.
Over 1,000 truckloads of aid were piled up on the Gazan side of the Kerem Shalom border crossing the day after Israel implemented a daily humanitarian pause in fighting to help increase the flow of aid throughout Gaza. While Israel continues to surge aid into Gaza, the United Nations has failed to increase its capacity to deliver and distribute resources. Israel is now taking unprecedented steps to improve the UN's ability to distribute aid, including with a daily pause of military activities in parts of Rafah. Quote, this tactical humanitarian pause is one way we are solving the issue of distribution, said Israeli Rear Admiral Hagari. Quote, we are again encouraging international organizations to do their job and make sure this stuff outside here will be distributed to the people of Gaza, unquote.
What does Israel have to do before the world will see that they are doing much more to protect the innocents than any other force today? And this while defending the lives of their citizens. Egad.
And the Wall Street Journal reported on the Al Jamal family, which was close to Hamas and held three Israeli hostages for the terror group in their neighborhood in Gaza. The 73-year-old father, Ahmad Al-Jamal, was a fixture of the community, a medical doctor, and an imam at a local mosque. Ahmad's son, 37-year-old Palestinian journalist Abdullah Al-Jamal, also lived in the family home with his wife and children. The rescued hostages said they could hear the family going about their daily lives in the apartment from their locked and guarded room. Just days before he was killed in the Israeli rescue operation, Abdullah published an article for the anti-Israel, U.S.-based Palestine Chronicle talking about Gazans displaced by the war, which he described as genocide and a massacre. The article was entitled, "My House Will Always Be Open."
Truth does not seem to be something the terrorists and their supporters hold dear. Is this family in Gaza not a terrorist? Isn't holding hostages a terrorist act? Aren't they terrorists?
And a proposal by Senate Democrats to require women to register for the draft ignited protests from Republicans, complicating the passage of the annual National Defense Authorization Act. The proposal, which Congress rejected before, was added to the bill in the Armed Services Committee, and while it's not expected to pass, it's likely to delay the bill. Senator Josh Hawley opposed the provision, calling it insane, stating that women shouldn't be forced to serve if they don't want to, and criticized Democrats for using the military for social experiments. Currently, only men aged 18 to 25 must register with a selective service, with options for deferments or exemptions if drafted.
I know it's politically incorrect to say that there's a difference between men and women, but I'll go bold and confirm, yes, there is. Yes, some women can and do serve honorably and well in our military. But do you really want to see every young female, every little girl out there ending up in the infantry? You know, infantry is where the biggest need for troops is. This is crazy.
And the first Ukrainian peace summit took place last weekend in Switzerland. It was attended by representatives from 100 countries and organizations. It resulted in the adoption of a joint declaration. Not all participants supported it. Specifically, Saudi Arabia, Thailand, India, Mexico, South Africa, Brazil, and the United Arab Emirates declined to sign the communique. Ukraine does not exclude Russia's participation in the second peace summit. However, their foreign minister emphasized that direct contact with the aggressor country will not occur.
This meeting was a good idea, but lots of signatures on a document of support doesn't equal financial or military support or anything. It was a good idea.
As Russian President Putin and Chinese Premier Li wrapped up separate meetings in Southeast Asia this month, the two partners in the BRICS economic bloc encountered a region keen to join a group seen as a hedge against Western-led institutions. Thailand, a U.S. treaty ally, last month announced its own bid to join BRICS, named after members Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. The bloc represents a South-South cooperative framework which Thailand has long desired to be a part of, their foreign minister told reporters. For countries seeking to mitigate the economic risks of intensifying U.S.-China competition, joining BRICS is an attempt to straddle some of those tensions. In Southeast Asia, many nations depend economically on trade with China while also simultaneously enjoying the security presence and investment Washington provides. But BRICS membership is also a way of signaling increasing frustration with the U.S.-led international order and key institutions that remain firmly in the control of Western powers, like the World Bank and International Monetary Fund.
This is a smart move on the part of Russia and China. In the past few decades, we've moved so much manufacturing to China, we are truly dependent on them, and they're taking full advantage of it. And that's the news. As Americans, it's our responsibility to ensure that our nation is well-run and on the right path. Politics and politicians are confusing, but we can work together. Concerned Veterans for America can assist you, even if you're not a veteran, in getting involved in getting our nation back on the right track. Working with them is one of the things I do. Check cvafrontlines.com. That's cvafrontlines.com. I think you'll find the options that you'll like. This is Colonel Denny Gillum coming up on Frontlines of Freedom. I'll share comments by the Colonel, and then we'll enjoy some warrant wisdom. And then we'll hear from Ambassador John Bolton. At ease, troops, take a break. In business for over 30 years with over $1 billion in sales, Universal Coin and Bullion is my go-to source for gold and silver coins. And right now, they're offering our listeners a newly minted 0.99 fine 1 ounce 2024 silver American Eagle coin for just $27. Call 800-UCB-GOLD, 800-UCB-GOLD, or go to their website at universalcoin.com/Denny.
This is Marine Vet Skip Coria with your home defense tip of the week. Most home invasions occur when people are at work between the hours of 10 a.m. and 3 p.m. Because of this, we highly recommend the installation of a home security video surveillance system. These systems are easy to install and cost only a few hundred dollars. They allow you to monitor your home while you're at work via your computer or cell phone. This is just one more way to keep your family safe. For more useful tips on home and personal defense, visit homedefenseshow.com.
HelpVet.net is a national help center helping the military community with all of your everyday needs. Whether you need a realtor, an attorney, health-related services, or information on retirement planning, financial resources, or more, our vast network of hand-picked qualified service providers are waiting to help you. With up-to-date military news and resources, you can find answers to all of your daily needs at HelpVet.net. HelpVet.net wants to thank you for your service, and may God continue to bless the U.S. of A.
Do you have a story inside you yearning to come out? As a self-published author, you are free to creatively distribute your book online or using your own professional connections. White Feather Press will publish your manuscript and set up online distribution, allowing the author to retain all copyright and distribution rights as well as all profits. Check out White Feather Press at publishyourdream.com. White Feather Press, reaffirming faith in God, family, and country. This is Colonel Denny Gillum. It is 20 minutes after the hour, and you are in formation and listening to the Front Lines of Freedom all across America. Troops, even if our economy wasn't a mess with inflation going crazy and prices out of sight, I'd still recommend that you do some investing in precious metals, gold and silver. I recommend you join me in purchasing these solid investments from Universal Coin. Find them at universalcoin.com/Denny. That's universalcoin.com/Denny. Now it's time for comments by the Colonel. I'm not sure why Russia hasn't totally crushed Ukraine. That war has seen its share of twists and turns over the past 27 months. The first year was largely defined by the Russian army's highly public missteps, from stranded gasless tanks to Russian soldiers redeploying to Donbass after a failed push to take Kiev. Then came Ukraine's counteroffensive in Kharkiv. The Ukrainians were riding high in November of 2022, so much so that our intelligence agencies picked up chatter. The Russian generals were talking about the use of tactical nukes. The situation, however, has deteriorated for the Ukrainians since then. The capture of Kherson in November of 22 was the high water mark of Ukraine's progress. Since then, the battlefield situation has slowly gone Russian. Moscow has retained more territory over the past 2 months than Ukraine did during its entire effort last year. President Zelensky is frustrated by Russia's current operations in Kharkiv, leading to Washington to loosen its ban on using U.S.-supplied weapons to hit targets inside Russia. All of this leads to the big question, when should Ukraine shift its strategy from total military victory toward a good enough peace? Hey, who wants a diplomatic settlement with Russia? Russia's the aggressor, invaded a sovereign neighbor, committed atrocities. Putin's wanted by the International Criminal Court for war crimes. Ukraine is the victim, the logic goes, and forcing it to sit at the same table with its victimizer is unreasonable. But that's only true to a degree. International politics isn't a morality contest. At times, it's an ugly, highly competitive slugfest between states where the ideal is not attainable. Zelensky has been adamant Ukraine will only negotiate with Russia after it withdraws its troops from all of Ukrainian land, including Crimea. Zelensky's 10-point peace plan, which demands a total Russian military withdrawal, Russian compensation for war damage, and war crime prosecutions for Russian soldiers, is in effect a surrender document for Moscow. He reiterated those same terms this month when dozens of countries met in Switzerland for a peace conference. Yet, that plan isn't credible. In fact, given the current state of the war, as well as Putin's willingness to sacrifice Russia's future to maintain the roughly 20% of Ukrainian territory his forces now occupy, Zelensky's position is delusional. The White House, of course, is highly unlikely to state this openly. First, that would cause extreme strain between Washington and Kyiv when both of them want to hold Ukraine's defensive lines. Second, we'd embarrass Zelensky by basically calling his proposal foolish, and the impact on morale within the Ukrainian army would be significant. I mean, who wants to risk their life for a draw? But none of this outweighs the fact on and off the battlefield, and like it or not, those facts now favor Russia. While Russia's casualties are steep, the UK Ministry of Defense estimates that 465,000 Russians have been killed or wounded so far. The Russian government is preparing for war, a war that could last for years. Putin consistently throws bodies into the fight. About 30,000 Russians join the ranks every month. And he's providing bonuses and benefits to attract more men. Despite the stringent U.S. and EU sanctions, Russia has redirected its crude oil sales, mainly to China and Russia, and is garnering tens of billions of dollars for his treasury. Ukraine doesn't have unlimited resources, and it has less of pretty much everything, less fighting-aged men, less artillery shells, and less wealth to spend on a war that continues with no end in sight. Their army is stretched along a 600-mile front line that's only gotten longer after Russia's push into Kharkiv, forcing Kyiv to redirect troops that would otherwise have been reinforcing the line in Donbas. Yet, Zelensky hesitates to call for a general mobilization, which would give soldiers fighting the front continuously for the past 2 years time to rest, lest this spur political turmoil in Kyiv or further shrink the Ukrainian workforce. This is not to suggest that Zelensky should surrender. Nothing is inevitable in war. The side that makes territorial gains this week could be retreating next week. The infusion of new U.S. aid to Ukraine is just starting to pour in, and the Ukrainians will want to see whether the latest efforts will enable them to recover lost ground. Any diplomatic settlement will also depend on Putin. He could refuse to compromise. But it's long past time for the war's observers and our policymakers who are involved in it to drop their delusions about total military victory. Like most wars in history, this one will end through a diplomatic process where neither side will be particularly enamored. The only question is how exhausted Ukraine and Russia need to get before they'll finally negotiate seriously. While I consider Putin and Russia to be war criminals, it's worth considering that they do have some real issues here. Crimea has been a part of Russia and or the Soviet Union since 1783. In 1954, the USSR transferred it to Ukraine, and after Ukrainian independence in 1991, the Ukrainian government and the Republic of Crimea clashed, with the region getting more autonomy. The Soviet fleet in Crimea was also in contention, but a 1997 treaty allowed Russia to continue basing its fleet in Sevastopol. In 2014, the peninsula was occupied by Russian forces and annexed by Russia. My point here is that Crimea has been the home port for Russia's southern fleet for a long time. Many of the people living there are very pro-Russian. Perhaps Russia would accept a general peace with Ukraine if they could regain ownership of Crimea. And those are my comments for today. This is Colonel Denny Gillum. You're listening to Frontlines of Freedom, and now we get to enjoy some warrant wisdom with Chief Warrant Officer Roland Ashby. What do you have this week, Roland?
Remember back when Trump was the president and he renegotiated the presidential airlift recapitalization contract with Boeing? Well, the contract originally had the first aircraft being delivered this year. However, there's no way that that's even come close to happening. The Air Force One replacement, known as VC-25B, is now scheduled for its first flight in March 2026. So how far behind is this project? Well, in 2022, the program schedule was re-baselined, with the first aircraft delivery pushed back to September 2026 and the second aircraft delivery for February 2027. But Boeing is once again in the process of updating the program schedule, and it's expected they'll be pushing it back another 2 to 3 years. The first delay is the power on of the first aircraft, which consists of ground-based testing of subsystems, and that was planned for last month, and now has been pushed to next year, July. The second delay is the aircraft's first flight, which was previously scheduled for November of this year, but that's already been pushed to March of 2026, another 16-month delay. Now, alongside staggering losses on programs like the KC-46 refueling tanker, the VC-25B program has been the poster child for Boeing for what they have admitted have been terrible fixed-priced agreements with the Pentagon. Boeing has lost over $2 billion so far on just the new Air Force One program. There have been a ton of issues for Boeing, which frankly seem to be par for the course lately. The subcontractor originally hired to furnish the jet's interiors went bankrupt, and Boeing had to go find a new supplier. Boeing also had an issue where certain employees didn't have the proper clearances, but worked on the program anyway, which of course caused security issues with the Pentagon. There's even been design issues, which caused Boeing to stop all wiring fabrication in 2022. You know, hopefully Boeing can get on top of all these issues and prove they can still be the world's top aircraft manufacturer. You know what? I'm rooting for them. For Frontlines of Freedom, I'm Chief Warrant Officer Roland Ashby. Back to you, Colonel.
Thanks, Roland. I enjoy your comments. Thank you. Straight ahead on Frontlines of Freedom, we'll talk with Ambassador John Bolton. Then we'll discuss the Center for Military Readiness. All this is coming up. I'm Colonel Dana Gillum. You're standing tall with the Frontlines of Freedom. I'll be right back. Troops, it's time for sit-ups. Do 50, then stand at ease.
America's veterans sacrificed in service to this country. They deserve quality medical care after taking off the uniform.
Concerned Veterans for America was instrumental in expanding access to needed care to millions of veterans by getting the VA Mission Act passed. But that fight continues until all veterans can get the care they need.
You can help empower veterans with better health care options. Visit CVAFrontlines.com to learn more and join the movement. That's CVAFrontlines.com.
Friends, there's not too many things I enjoy more than helping veterans and eating great beef jerky. Now I can do both. My good friends at Tango3.org and America's Best Beef Jerky use the highest quality beef to make the best jerky I've ever tasted. Trust me, I've eaten a lot. But that's not all. They give 100% of the profit to vetted veterans programs, mental health and suicide prevention. Go to americasbestbeefjerky.com and order now. And at checkout, check the Frontlines of Freedom promo code. Troops, welcome back to our nation's largest military veteran talk radio show, Frontlines of Freedom. I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. And troops, please do send me your comments and questions. Email me through frontlinesoffreedom.com. It's an honor to welcome back to the show Ambassador John Bolton. He's been a guest on this show periodically for 17 years. He served as our nation's ambassador to the United Nations and has served our nation in a number of other ways. So welcome back, Mr. Ambassador. Thanks for joining us.
Glad to be back with you.
Sir, besides being an ambassador, I know you held some other positions. What are some of the other positions you have served our nation?
Well, I've been honored to be in four different administrations. Most recently, I was a national security advisor in the Trump administration, but I served in the State Department at the Agency for International Development and the Justice Department under Ed Meese and Dick Thornburg back in the Reagan years. So I've been very lucky.
Well, thank you for your service. Okay. Well, I'd like to discuss China at some length, but first, can I get your views on the Ukraine war, where it seems to be headed?
Well, I don't think it's headed in a good place. I think the delay in getting assistance to the Ukrainians gave the Russians a bit of an opening where they've been able to change the momentum on the battlefield. I think the Ukrainians have stopped that now. But I think the unfortunate position we're in after more than 2 years since the Russian invasion is that the front lines are basically frozen. I don't see what would change them dramatically in the near term. And I think at some point, and I'm actually a little surprised it hasn't happened already, I could see Putin saying, look, this war has gone on long enough. Let's have a ceasefire in place and start negotiations. And I think the Europeans are weary of the war. I'm afraid they'd say that sounds great. I worry that the Biden administration would do the same thing. And I think once negotiations open under those conditions, Russia has a new border with Ukraine, and they've more than doubled the territory under Russian control from what it was after the 2014 conflict. So I'm just worried that Putin has evaded the sanctions. They have had an economic effect on Russia, but not substantial and not enough to bring their war-making capability to a halt. So although it's not really a great victory for Russia, Putin could paint it that way and then take a few years off to regroup and rearm and then come back at it again.
Yes, sir. That certainly is a realistic, and who knows, stay tuned. How about Israel, sir?
Well, you know, the Biden administration has put such intense pressure on Israel not to do what they said they were going to do after October 7th, which was eliminate Hamas's military and political capabilities, that for months now, the remainder of Hamas's organized fighting capability has been able to hold out in those tunnels in South Gaza under Rafah. And the Israeli Defense Forces have not been able to do what they can to free the remaining hostages, to get Yahya Sinwar, the Hamas head in Gaza, and other leaders, and really dismantle the Hamas government. And, you know, the longer they're not able to do that, the harder it's going to be, the more Hamas leaders are going to escape, and the more difficulty Israel is going to face in the north from Hezbollah, where you can see tensions building up there. All of this is due to Iran. This is that they have armed and equipped and trained and financed all these terrorist groups, Hamas, the Houthis in Yemen, Hezbollah, the Shia militia groups in Iraq and Syria that have attacked our civilian and military positions there. I can't read exactly what Iran thinks its strategy is, but they're the ones who are unleashing this, what they themselves call ring of fire strategy around Iran. And the Biden administration just doesn't see the strategy.
Yes, sir. It's really clear that the goal of Hamas and Hezbollah and their leader, Iran, is eliminating Israel and all Jews. And so how do you have an agreement with anybody that's their goal? I don't see that at all.
No, look, if Israel were to sit down and try and negotiate with Hamas, it would be seen as a huge victory for their barbaric strategy on October the 7th. That Hamas would be seen ultimately as being victorious over Israel simply to survive. And that would give all of Israel's enemies in Iran and elsewhere in the region reason for celebration, and they too would regroup and they'd be back at it soon enough. And I think the Arab regimes on the Arabian Peninsula, the oil-producing monarchies, see the threat from Iran pretty much the way Israel does. And they would be appalled once again that the United States wasn't able to act clearly against what really is the major threat to peace and security in the Middle East, and that's Iran.
Yes, sir. This is Colonel Denny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. We're talking with Ambassador John Bolton. Okay, sir, let's talk China. It's really clear to me that China wants to take us out as a major power. They say that's what they want to do, and they're doing all they can to take us down. But we seem to be naively going along with them. Am I missing something?
No, I think... The only good news I could say is I think more and more people are waking up to what you're describing, that they can see the Chinese threat is economic, stealing our intellectual property, weaponizing companies like ZTE and Huawei to take over fifth generation telecommunications, obviously threatening Taiwan, threatening to take over the physical islands and rocks and reefs in the South China Sea, threatening along their land borders in Asia, building a blue water navy for the first time in 600 years, building up their nuclear capability, obviously have enormous cyber offensive capabilities and the like. So I think people are beginning to get the picture, certainly in the U.S., less so in Europe. And that means once we're aware of what the threat is, we've got a chance to deal with it. But again, we're not seeing a coherent response by the White House. We're seeing a group of people who are more concerned about negotiating a climate change agreement with China than in protecting core American national interests. So we've still got a long way to go. There's no doubt about it. More people need to know about it. They need to talk about it, and they need to ask themselves, what do we need to do to protect ourselves and our friends and allies? We need to get to it. We need a much bigger defense industrial base. I can tell you that's one place to start.
Yes, sir. We have foolishly, over a generation or so, have shipped much of our manufacturing to China. We certainly need to get it back. I think if you and I suddenly had enough money to build a factory that would make medicine, we couldn't find anybody that would work in it. We don't have the people trained. And we don't seem to have any national recognition that we have to be doing this.
And, yeah, I mean, look at our inability to manufacture enough artillery shells to supply Ukraine with what they need and also keep our own arsenal stocked. I mean, the only good news is we're replacing old shells with newer shells, really across the board, all the weapon systems and ammunition we're supplying Ukraine. We're improving the quality of what we're building, but we need more factory capability. We need more shipbuilding capability. We need more missile production capability, and we can build it now while the threat is still a little bit more remote, or we can build it while we're under fire. And there's no doubt what the right answer is there.
No, sir. And didn't Russia and China just sign or are working on signing some kind of an agreement to work together?
Yeah. And the Chinese, look, they've been helping Russia out in this war from Ukraine from the beginning, but they've deceived a number of Westerners, including in this country, who don't think they are. You've seen that Vladimir Putin has been in North Korea the past couple of days. North Koreans are selling them artillery and ammunition, and the Russians and the North Koreans are going to cooperate together. Really, that's part of the growing axis between Russia and China. This time, unlike the Cold War, China's the dominant partner. There are certainly strains in that relationship, still building, and competition for influence with North Korea is an example of it. But make no mistake, directionally, they are our adversaries. And North Korea is an adversary. Iran is an adversary. But you can't get a lot of people still to this day in this country to understand that.
That is surprising to me, but I guess it's where we are. And I suspect it's not too inappropriate to say this upcoming presidential election may be the way to change things.
Well, it's certainly an occasion for Americans to have a debate. I mean, historically, when our people have been told you face a real challenge and here's what we need to do to meet it, we've stepped up to it. We can do it again. We haven't lost a step on this. It's just our politicians who, as you said a moment ago, for 30 years haven't paid adequate attention to what's happening around the world. And so we're playing catch up to an extent, but we can do it.
Yes, sir. There's more to talk about China, and Ambassador Bolton's going to stay with us. This is Colonel Danny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. Yeah, it's time for push-ups. They want you to do 103 push-ups. That's how many I do, well, usually sometimes a week. Then take a break, but stay in the area. I'll be right back.
Friends, Adam here, Patriot Foods, U.S. only company. Frozen fruits and vegetables straight from our dirt, not overseas. Support the U.S. farmer. When you shop at patriotfoods.com, we give back to a military family in need. We got to take care of each other, my friends. We have to. So important. 10% off patriotfoods.com. 10% off promo code FREEDOM and shop today.
Silver has increased 24% over the past 15 months and is a solid financial investment. Silver is projected to continue its rise and is nowhere near its 2011 high of $49 an ounce. So there's still a lot of room for investment growth. Call 800-UCB-GOLD or go to their website at universalcoin.com/Denny. That's universalcoin.com/Denny. This is Colonel Denny Gillum. This is the final formation for this hour on Frontlines of Freedom. We're continuing our conversation with Ambassador Bolton about China. Sir, it's just, I don't know what we the people can do except to insist that our elected officials, particularly at the federal government level, pay attention to this. We can communicate with our senators and our congressmen and take that into account in voting for president. There's not much else that we can do, is there?
Well, I think it's important in the House and the Senate races, too. You know, we face a body of opinion in the country that's really isolationist in its thinking. There's no other way to characterize it. They don't want to deal with problems around the world. And, you know, that's the kind of mentality that just means we get the problems here at home all the more quickly. I mean, take, for example, the fentanyl crisis. You know, 10 years ago, the bulk of the fentanyl that comes into this country was actually manufactured in China. And I was with President Trump on a couple of occasions when he met with Chinese leader Xi Jinping. Xi Jinping denied they were doing it, of course, but said he would look into the question whether some illegal activity was going on in China. it's illegal only in a perfunctory sense. They knew exactly what was going on. But what's happened over particularly the past 5 years is that the fentanyl manufacturing has shifted from China to Mexico and other places in this hemisphere, which, by the way, cuts transportation costs for the Chinese so they can sell it in America at an even lower price. And so when people say we need to control the southern border, there are a lot of good reasons to control the southern border. One is illegal immigration. Two is the flow of fentanyl across that border and other illegal drugs. And three is the threat of foreign terrorists coming across to carry out terrorist attacks in this country or to carry out other operations. I mean, one of the amazing things on the southern border now is the number of Chinese people coming in saying they want economic asylum because they're worried about the Chinese economy. Now, maybe that's what some of them really want, and maybe they'd make good entrepreneurs in America. But my guess is some of them are Chinese operatives who are coming in with the intention of doing bad things to us. So it's another important thing we have to wake up to.
Yes, sir. That was my second topic. So we're thinking the same way. Our southern border is a disaster. And if only 1% of the people that have been let in illegally are evil, foreign agents, criminals, drug smugglers, whatever, that's a whole bunch. And if it's more than 1%, how could there not be? How could China not take advantage of that?
Sure. I mean, they know from, for example, Iran, which even during the Obama administration, they brought an indictment against the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps, a couple of their officers, for planning to come across the Mexican border and assassinate the Saudi Arabian ambassador to the U.S. at a restaurant in Washington. And that was 10 years ago or more. And we know the Iranians have targeted a number of people, myself included, from the Trump administration and others for the decision that led to Qasem Soleimani, the head of the Quds Force, his early exit. So it's not hard to understand that if you want to put people into the United States, you come through at a vulnerable point. And they all know where that vulnerable point is. And unfortunately, it extends across much of the southern border.
And one of the things that I've asked some people that are not too unhappy about this, name one good thing for America and Americans that this open southern border has. What's one good thing that it does for us? We've always let people into our country legally because they met certain standards. They wanted to be Americans there. They brought skills we needed. What's one good thing that all this, these millions of people that we don't even know anything about, how's that good for us?
Yeah, look, an orderly immigration process is a sign that we've got control over sovereignty. We let in the people we want. And many of these folks who are willing to walk across Central America and Mexico could make good citizens if they thought that they stood a chance, you know, wait their time, get in line in effect, you know, then we'd welcome them as citizens. And there are plenty of people around the world who we could grant political asylum to, people in Hong Kong who fought for their freedom there until Beijing suppressed it. I mean, I can think of a lot of places that we could look for good new Americans. And we see now in China, the birth rate's going down. It means their population is going to decline. That's ultimately a source of their own national security, as it is for us, too. So welcoming immigrants in as we set the rules for them to come in help make America great. And it can continue to do that.
Yes, sir. And I couldn't imagine us ever not doing that. But if we have laws about what's legal immigration and our government doesn't obey it, is the government breaking the law?
Well, the government's derelict of duty. There's no doubt about it. And I think Americans can see, you can see it in this election. It's one reason why immigration is such a big issue. And it's, you know, contrary to what some people say that it's a sign of racism or something, it's not at all. And you can see many Americans, Hispanic American people who waited their turn, who went through the residency requirement, who took the citizenship test. Many of them now work for the Border Patrol or they live and work in Texas in the oil industry and feel just as strongly about the problem of illegal immigration as people whose ancestors came on the Mayflower. It really is. It's not about ethnicity. It's about who controls our borders? Who controls immigration? And is it we, the existing American people, or is it somebody else?
Yes, sir. This is Colonel Denny Gilliam on Frontlines of Freedom. We're talking with Ambassador John Bolton. And whatever it is, I believe our country is as insecure as it's been in my lifetime. We don't know who's here. We don't know what they stand for. And that's not getting to the fact that our military is now focused on proper pronouns not being combat ready. But just who's in, and we don't know who they are, and we don't know what they're trying to do. I guess we're going to have to wait until people start getting attacked and killed.
Well, it's a grim prospect. I mean, the country's very divided internally on politics and a number of other things. That's not a good sign. And, you know, I would hope through the political process we can come to a greater sense of unity. But the historical record is it often takes some external catastrophe to wake us up. And I don't want to contemplate that. But there's evidence all around. If you look to come back to Israel, not only are they under threat, obviously, from these terrorist groups, these surrogates, proxies of Iran, they're under threat from Iran's nuclear weapons program, which is continuing to expand. We've watched that happen. We watched it happen with North Korea. It's happening right now again in China. So we've got, even at the nuclear level, we're about to be overwhelmed by threats from countries that we never worried about before. We worried about the Soviet Union and its nuclear arsenal during the Cold War. Now we've got to worry about China and several others, and we're not prepared for it. Now, the American people need to be alerted to these threats. And as I said before, if they are, I think they'll know what to do.
Yes, sir. 40-something years ago, I was a Mideast war planner. And as I recollect, Iran and the other radical Islamists referred to Israel as the little Satan and America as the big Satan, which means we're on their hit list, too.
Yeah, that's why people often call Israel the canary in the coal mine for the United States. When people come after them, it's not just Israel they're interested in. We're next on the list or somewhere down the line, no doubt about it.
And we got to do something about it because we're not. Okay. Sir, let's put that down. Take a minute now and give us an overview of what you are doing and how people can stay plugged into you.
Well, thanks very much. You know, I'm concerned over the long term about the spread of this isolationist sentiment in the country. And so through a variety of different mechanisms, I've got websites for all of them. I try and help get elected to the House and the Senate, people who understand American national security, what we need to do to protect it, who will be strong advocates for Ronald Reagan's peace through strength approach to foreign policy. And I do that through a PAC, through a tax-exempt institute, through a foundation that can do both politics and policy work. To work with members of Congress once they get here to Washington. This is a long-term struggle, but I think it's important because ultimately the fate of the country is in the people's hands, and you got to count on them to do the right thing. I'm just trying to help that along.
Yes, sir. How can people plug into that? Do you have a website or something people can use?
Sure. There's a website for boltonpack.com, for the Foundation for American Security and Freedom, fasfreedom.com, and for the Institute for a Secure America. So please look them up, take a look at the websites, and be in touch.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador, for your excellent comments and for your nonstop service to our nation. I'm proud that we're friends.
Well, thanks. I'm proud to be your friend, too, Dan.
God bless you, sir. This concludes the first hour of the show. We'll start the second hour talking with Elaine Donnelly from the Center for Military Readiness. Then Terry Lanting will present a song, and Diane Raver presents the movie of the month. And of course, we'll conclude with our weekly mailbag in military history and our self-defense report. This is Colonel Denny Gilliam on Frontlines of Freedom. Troops, it's time for pull-ups. Do 40 good ones, maybe 20 more push-ups. Grab some protein, rehydrate with water. And finally, put a big smile on your proud-to-be-an-American face and send me your thoughts by email or on Facebook.